Here are some highlights from this month's episode of Keeping Up. We hope you enjoy. We knew air travel was dangerous in that you can get infectious diseases in the cabin, but listen to this litany of diseases that Keith got when he was an 8-year-old flying on an airplane.
I had measles as an 8-year-old. I got it on an airplane. I had rabies as an 8-year-old. I got it on an airplane. I had leishmaniasis as an 8-year-old. I got it on an airplane. I had leprosy as an 8-year-old. I got it on an airplane. I had malaria as an 8-year-old. I got it on an airplane. I had TB as an 8-year-old. I got it on an airplane.
Well, Keith, what are you going to do about all these illnesses you caught on this plane flight?
I'm taking the ceftriaxone.
Keith, is there any illness you didn't have as a kid?
I didn't have mumps as a child, and I didn't get the vaccine because it wasn't around when I was young.
Obviously, Keith didn't have all these infectious diseases traveling on that airplane, but he did have one of them, so you'll have to stay tuned to figure out which one it was, although you can probably tell with my editing skill. Or how often does a patient get some sort of a pharyngeal abscess after a sore throat? The British call that a quinsy. Matter of fact, that's...
I love that term.
Quinsy.
We should use it.
Here's a little trivia for you. What did George Washington die of?
Quinsy.
How did you know that?
I don't know.
Tis true, he did. He sounds so British, saying quinsy a lot.
I like quinsy.
It makes it sound smart.
Do you have any tea?
Oh, very nice. Promethazine has been given a FDA black box warning in children less than 2 years of age because of its excessive sedation, respiratory depression, and even some deaths in this population. So do not use it in kids less than 24 months. Promethazine is Phenergan. And if you get akathisia on a helicopter, or if your patient gets it, that's bad, because there's only one place that patient's going to go if they start wandering around inside that helicopter, and that's down.
I'll just go straight with several points about Wernicke's encephalopathy. The classic triad of mental status changes, ophthalmoplegia, and gait ataxia occurs in less than 10% of patients. Ophthalmoplegia is rare, and other ocular abnormalities are much more common, the most common ocular abnormality being nystagmus. This is a clinical diagnosis, and I think we ought to be over-diagnosing rather than under-diagnosing, so should have a low threshold to just treat this. It's important to remember that acute glucose administration does not precipitate Wernicke's. It's chronic glucose administration which does that. So you don't need to delay glucose administration in a hypoglycemic in order to get thiamine on board first. That's a true myth.
The authors
think in almost anything in a nutritionally defined patient equals thiamine. So.
Stub toe, nutritionally deficient thiamine. Remember the symptoms of hypercalcemia. Stones, bones, groans, and psychiatric overtones. Is there another owns that I'm forgetting?
Moans.
And this doesn't have an own thing to rhyme with, but hypercalcemia causes nephrogenic diabetes insipidus.
I'm going to reiterate one thing that you said, and I think it's an own. It's dehydration.
yeah, it is.
All of these
so
people
good.
Are dehydrated. I had so many basophils, you wouldn't believe it.
If you've got old people bitten by a skeeter, who cares?
Who's not in the South? So.
I don't know. Old people, skeeters.
Here's my take on tropical medicine. Malaria.
TB.
TB, HIV, and leishmaniasis.
Leishmaniasis and leprosy.
And leprosy. Those five things. You just think about those five things. You'd be right about 97.6% of the time.
And most of the patients will have all of the above.
Yes, often they do.
TB, HIV,
yes.
Got it all.
I had leishmaniasis as a child as well.
Good grief.
I had
you're
everything.
So full of crap. Are you serious?
Yeah.
Did you catch it on a plane?
No, I caught it in Panama. I had a big sore on my leg. Just went away. We didn't treat it.
Sheesh. Did you get antimony or whatever?
No, just...
Pentastin?
I got to go to the beach and soak in the ocean for a week and out of school.
That's sweet.
Yes, it is.
Man, I wish I could get leishmaniasis. Do you think Corey would let me off work?
No.
Okay. Well, there's lots more learning and lots more fun yet to come on this month's episode of Keeping Up. I'm with Dr. Keith Wren, and it is going to be so much fun. You're really going to enjoy yourself. So stay tuned for this month's episode. We're doing general medicine articles. Welcome to Keeping Up. Our mission here is to help you as emergency physicians to keep up with cutting-edge medical literature and to bring current research to bear on your clinical practice and to do it on your time schedule. We're bringing you a monthly digital recording reviewing the top 10 articles from the past year focused on a specific clinical domain in emergency medicine. And these recordings are structured to be high yield. Each one is going to give you the historical backdrop so you know how this article fits into core emergency medicine knowledge. We're also going to give you the ABIM board relevance of the article every time we can. Next, we're going to present the results of the article concisely. This is not meant to be a journal club. It's meant to give you what you need to know. And finally, we're going to give you the application to your day-to-day practice. We're going to tell you how this article is going to change what you do on your next shift. And don't forget to check out our website, www.keepingupinem.com. You can check us out for free. You can get all of these recordings in the past months for free. This month, we're presenting the top 10 medicine articles, general medical articles from the past 12 months. Now, since medicine is so broad, we're going to give you 10 articles this month, and then a couple of months down the road, we're going to give you 10 more. We've worked really hard to do the searching for you, and we've handpicked these articles from over 60 journals to get you the very best, most relevant articles to help keep you up with emergency medicine literature. Today, I have with me Dr. Keith Wren. Dr. Wren is the vice chairman of the department, and he is going to bring some razor-sharp wit to this presentation. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, enjoy, and start keeping up with emergency medicine literature. Don't forget this is copyright material. It's copyright Vanderbilt University 2008, all rights reserved. And you can get an hour of CME credit for listening to a one-hour podcast. You can't beat that. So without further ado, we will get down to business. All right, for our first article, this is by Broad et al. On dancitron versus promethazine to treat acute undifferentiated nausea in the emergency department. A randomized, double-blind, non-inferiority trial. This was in Academic Emergency Medicine, March 2008. The historical backdrop. Nausea and vomiting is an extremely common ED complaint. Promethazine has been a mainstay for ED docs to control nausea, but the problem is sedation. We're trying to rapidly improve a patient's condition and get fast turnaround, and promethazine presents a problem because the patient may no longer be nauseated, but they're also no longer awake, and you can't send them home if they're obtunded on a Phenergan. Hence, this trial compares promethazine head-to-head with ondansetron. Now, ondansetron, or Zofran, is a 5-HT3 serotonin receptor antagonist initially marketed for use in chemotherapy, preventing and treating chemotherapy-induced nausea, and also post-op nausea. But we quickly learned that this incredible antiemetic was good for any cause of nausea, and it's non-sedating. For your boards, here's what I think you need to know. Promethazine has been given a FDA black box warning in children less than 2 years of age because of its excessive sedation, respiratory depression, and even some deaths in this population. So do not use it in kids less than 24 months. Promethazine is Phenergan. And I also recommend not using it in any smaller children. There's also important to know a recent meta-analysis in September of this year in Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine found that ondansetron is safe and effective in children and reduced the need for IV fluid administration and hospitalization. Ondansetron is a good thing. So on to the results of the study. This study was adequately powered and enrolled 120 patients, which were randomized to receive either promethazine 25 mg IV or ondansetron 4 mg IV. The outcome measures were nausea, anxiety, and sedation, and all of these were measured using a 100 mm visual analog scale at baseline and then 30 minutes after they got the drug. For those of you who can't picture a visual analog scale, just picture a line 100 millimeters long, and the patient's told, mark on the line, at the left, no nausea, at the right, the worst possible nausea you can imagine, and wherever they make the mark, they measured in millimeters, and that's how nauseated they are. That's how they quantified it. This study was funded by GlaxoSmithKline, but was conceived by the authors and conducted with no input from that company. Nausea reduction was the same in the two groups, as was anxiety. However, sedation, as you would imagine, was much greater in the promethazine group and was highly statistically significant, and I think clinically significant as well. It was a 19 millimeter increase in sedation for promethazine versus only a 5 millimeter increase in sedation for ondansetron. Also, ondansetron showed a trend toward improved long-term outcome, although only 77% could be contacted at 24 hours, and the study wasn't really powered to detect long-term differences. There was a trend in that direction. Two patients in the promethazine group had akathisia versus none in the ondansetron group. So, how does this apply to your next shift? I routinely reach for ondansetron as my first-line antiemetic these days. It works extremely well, and it causes less sedation. This is very important in patients that already may have some degree of altered mental status or head injury. Additionally, I think the traumatized patients should not get promethazine. It clouds their mental status, and if you get akathisia on a helicopter, or if your patient gets it, that's bad, because there's only one place that patient's going to go if they start wandering around inside that helicopter, and that's down. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts on this are that I have two major complaints, and one is that it's a non-inferiority trial. We probably ought to talk about what that means, and I think we ought to specifically talk about it in the setting of this paper, because if you look at the numbers, it took them 28 months to get 120 subjects, which ends up being about one a week. And I suspect that they were originally trying to do a real trial and switched midstream when they weren't getting enough patients to do a non-inferiority trial, because it takes less patients to prove non-inferiority. The reason that's important is because they themselves in a previous study have shown that promethazine was no better than normal saline in showing improvement in nausea. So I'm worried that this trial was a bust, and they still managed to get it published because they did some fooling around. Secondly, if you read carefully in here, six of the patients, 19 out of the 120, had a problem with the measurements. They weren't done with the VAS scale. They were done on a 1 to 10 scale.
And, right.
I don't know how that changes, but I don't think you can definitely say the 1 to 10 scale verbally is the same as a 100 millimeter VAS scale. So I worry a lot about that as a problem in this study.
Yeah, the research assistants said, well, if they're a 5 out of 10 as far as nausea measurement, then that would equate to a 50 millimeter visual analog scale. But yeah, it's,
you know, it's and tough. I know, yeah, sitting in triage, that you ask people who don't even have chest pain as a complaint to do that verbal thing, and you're going to get a 5
yeah.
or 4. I mean, so I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
I don't think they've ever been compared. I think it weakens. The third point is that we used to worry about ondansetron because it was expensive. It's not that expensive now. And they quote a price of $317 versus $180 for Phenergan, so it doesn't make much difference. The last point I would make is it really looks to me like, if you look at the results, that Phenergan works a little better with more side effects early on, but ondansetron appears to work longer in that people... Now, I don't know if these things are statistically significant, but they might become such if they had adequate numbers. But it appears to work longer. And it brings up the point, in the run-of-the-mill patient, not the trauma patient you mentioned, maybe you should use both together.
Well,
and you don't have cross-side effects there. And so I wonder about a trial in the future that would look at those two things versus one or the other, because depending on what other people show, we have a trial going on here, we might, that would be an interesting thought.
I've never heard of that, and I've never seen that done, but it makes sense because it did have a trend. Certainly, it wasn't statistically significant, but there was a trend toward improved long-term outcomes at 24 hours out. So,
I don't know that this changes my practice. I agree with you. I would use ondansetron first, but I've seen plenty of people I've had to add Phenergan on later.
Yeah. Is that what you're doing these days? Do you reach for ondansetron first as your antiemetic of choice, or are you reaching more for...
I usually reach for Zofran, unless somebody tells me Zofran doesn't work for them, which I get occasionally from various people. And then I'll go with whatever they tell me works for them. There are some times when I reach for Compazine, but that's usually in people who have nausea plus a headache, because I'm treating the headache
And then they get akathisia and they want to leave the department. So it works perfectly.
So the next article is from Donino et al., Myths and Misconceptions of Wernicke's Encephalopathy, What Every Emergency Physician Should Know. It's in Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2007. Wernicke's has been with us officially since 1881. It was first described in a non-alcoholic patient. It's since become strongly associated with alcoholism, though. And I think the major point that you ought to take away is this is a difficult diagnosis and often missed. In terms of board relevance, there's no real study here, so I'll just go straight with several points about board relevance. The classic triad of mental status changes, ophthalmoplegia, and gait ataxia, occurs in less than 10% of patients. So you may have one of these and more than that, but the most common one would probably be mental status changes. Ophthalmoplegia is rare, and other ocular abnormalities are much more common, the most common ocular abnormality being nystagmus. So we probably ought to substitute ocular abnormalities rather than ophthalmoplegia in the triad. Other signs include hypotension, bradycardia, hypoglycemia, and lactic acidosis. If you're treating people, the problem which resolves the quickest with treatment are ocular signs. Gait would be a little less quick, and then altered mental status would be the slowest. It's important to realize that there are many other conditions besides alcoholism that cause Wernicke's. I think this is probably one of the more important things to take away. And the things you need to think about are patients with AIDS, patients with malignancies, patients with hyperemesis gravidarum, people who are on prolonged TPN, post-surgical patients, and in recent years, they're really talking about gastric bypass, and then GI malabsorption states. There are other thiamine deficiency syndromes to keep in mind. There's Korsakoff's, which is what Wernicke's essentially turns into if you don't treat it properly, and may turn into even if you do treat it properly. There's cardiac beriberi, there's neuropathic beriberi, and there's a newly described entity called gastrointestinal beriberi. Korsakoff's is persistent memory loss and confabulation. At least 80% of people with Wernicke's will develop some degree of this, no matter how you treat them. Cardiac beriberi is typically high-output failure. It's often right-sided. Neuropathic beriberi is a sensory motor or peripheral neuropathy. It's more seen in the lower extremities rather than the upper extremities. It would be the opposite of central cord syndrome. And then gastrointestinal beriberi is an interesting thing consisting of abdominal pain, vomiting, and lactic acidosis without other obvious reasons. Application to practice. This is a clinical diagnosis, and I think we ought to be over-diagnosing rather than under-diagnosing, so should have a low threshold to just treat this. Treatment of the actual syndrome is with parenteral replacement of thiamine, and that usually means IV. I think the minimum dose you would use is 100. That's the standard 100 milligrams. That's the standard dose that we use. Some advocate 500 milligrams, particularly in people who do not appear to be getting better, who are maybe a little sicker. And it looks like if you're using 100 or 500, because of the half-life is only about 97 minutes, you should be using multiple doses per day, so three or four times a day. I think you can prophylax against this orally in patients without GI syndromes, although many alcoholics do have malabsorption that's subclinical. Nutritional deficiencies are not usually single, so you have to do concomitant multivitamin replacement with other B vitamins. The ones that are most important are niacin, pantothenic acid, and pyridoxine. And then lastly, there are some things that can precipitate Wernicke's in people who are at risk. Infection is number one, but it's important to remember that acute glucose administration does not precipitate Wernicke's. It's chronic glucose administration which does that. So you don't need to delay glucose administration in a hypoglycemic in order to get thiamine on board first. That's a true myth. Finally, allergy to thiamine in parenteral form does occur. It's very rare, and it occurs in all forms. So if they're allergic to thiamine, you're allergic to thiamine, whether you take it orally, IM, or IV, it doesn't really matter.
Now, one wonders how you could be allergic to an essential B vitamin.
It's probably the carriers that are used in various places. But there are studies from Panama in the 1920s where they were given thiamine to workers that were Jamaican workers who had Wernicke's, and they had allergic responses. So I don't know. It's probably how it's formulated.
How do you know that? Anyway, that's okay.
I don't know. I actually did a study on Wernicke's.
In the 20s?
No. I had to read about a study in the 20s in order to do the study we did. So.
I was really surprised that that classic triad of altered mental status, ophthalmoplegia, and gait ataxia is present in only 10% of the patients. But I agree, and the authors suggest that we need to just forget about ophthalmoplegia as the classic triad and just say ocular abnormalities, nystagmus, or other cranial nerve abnormalities. So I'm thinking altered mental status in a nutritionally deprived patient equals thiamine.
The authors, I'm thinking almost anything in a nutritionally deprived patient equals thiamine. So.
Stubbed toe, nutritionally deficient, thiamine. The author said, treat the patient if they have two of the following: nutritional deficiency, ocular findings, ataxia, or altered mental status. And I mean, it's, again, it's better to over-treat. You're going to be hard-pressed to hurt somebody with thiamine because the anaphylaxis to it is extremely rare. The next article is by LeGrand et al. It's Narrative Review, Furosemide for Hypercalcemia, an Unproven Yet Common Practice. It's in the Annals of Internal Medicine, August of 2008. The historical backdrop is this. We were always taught that in hypercalcemic patients, the quickest way to rapidly lower the calcium was to give IV saline and furosemide, so-called forced diuresis. Furosemide is a calciuric agent. It causes calcium loss in the urine, unlike the thiazides, which actually cause calcium retention. Remember the symptoms of hypercalcemia: stones, bones, groans, and psychiatric overtones. Is there another owns that I'm forgetting?
Moans.
Anyway, it causes bone pain, can predispose to stones, causes abdominal pain that's nonspecific, and it can cause alteration of mental status, especially in elderly patients. And this doesn't have an own thing to rhyme with, but hypercalcemia causes, in effect, nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. So these patients will have symptoms like diabetes. They'll have polyuria and polydipsia, and they'll often be dehydrated when they present to the ED. The most common cause of hypercalcemia is idiopathic hyperparathyroidism, but the most common cause that leads to hospitalization and, obviously, ED visits is malignancy. The dogma of saline and furosemide diuresis to treat hypercalcemia came from case reports done prior to the days of the bisphosphonates. Hence, this literature review is going to see how this long-entrenched dogma fares in the face of rigorous scientific study. So the board relevance: know the symptoms of hypercalcemia that I described above, and suspect hypercalcemia if you have a patient with altered mental status and a history of cancer. That'd be a good board question. The results. Well, this wasn't a study. It was a literature review. Only 9 studies looked at furosemide and saline forced diuresis. And the last of these studies was done in 1983, and only one of these was of any size. The largest study was a case series of about 37 patients. The protocol for this was Lasix or furosemide was to be given at 100 milligrams per hour. This is super high dose. And cases in which normal doses were given failed to normalize the calcium. Several patients had serious metabolic derangements, including profound hypernatremia, hypophosphatemia, hypomagnesemia, and tetany, and some had metabolic acidosis. Now, when the studies of bisphosphonates and hypercalcemia were reviewed, not 9, but over 34, not case series, but randomized controlled trials with over 1,000 patients were discovered. Phase 1 through 3 trials had been conducted with various bisphosphonates, and most of these were successful in lowering the calcium in over 70% of the trials, and they had minimal side effects. So, how's this apply to your next shift? Well, some would argue that you need furosemide, and it might still have a role since the bisphosphonates don't have a calcium-lowering effect for about 48 hours. However, if there is any shred of evidence for the use of furosemide as a calciuric agent in the setting of forced diuresis, it's to use insanely high doses of furosemide that none of us ever use, and that is fraught with serious side effects. Additionally, a lot of the time, these hypercalcemic patients get dehydrated from the nephrogenic diabetes insipidus effect of the hypercalcemia, and they're frequently given furosemide too early, before they're actually volume replete. So what are you supposed to do? So you give some saline and you give bisphosphonates, but you know the calcium's not going to come down with the bisphosphonates for 48 hours. Well, the authors recommend this. Start saline. They're probably going to need at least 4 liters. And start a bisphosphonate in conjunction with your friendly oncologist. And in the meantime, give them a dose of subcutaneous calcitonin. Calcitonin has a rapid onset effect, and the authors recommend a dose of 4 units per kilogram, Q12 hours. You get tachyphylaxis with this agent, but who cares? By that time, you're going to have the bisphosphonates kicking in. So I think that's a reasonable management protocol. Saline, calcitonin, 4 units per kilo, Q12, and get your bisphosphonates going.
It'll be hard for a lot of people to get rid of Lasix, but I'm going to reiterate one thing that you said, and I think it's an own. It's dehydration.
yeah, it is.
All of these people are dehydrated, and they are very often hypokalemic to start with. So when you think about that, using Lasix up front is fraught with problems. So you'll make their potassiums go lower. You'll dehydrate them more. So I think the key issue is hydration up front.
Yeah.
If you're going to do Lasix, you have to be very sure that you have hydrated them aggressively up front. You're going to need Foley's in. You're going to need really good urine output, et cetera. You're going to need to manage it very carefully. And you're going to need to be putting potassium up in most of these people.
Right.
Another point I'd like to make is that people talk about the EKG changes of hyperkalemia being QT shortening.
Hypercalcemia,
I'm sorry. I mean, QT shortening.
Mm-hmm.
That really probably almost never exists. It's been shown in at least one study, and we did a study here ourselves that showed the other metabolic abnormalities that are associated, the hypomagnesemia and hypokalemia, which prolong QT, more than take away that. So you can't depend on any EKG findings for hypercalcemia. It just doesn't happen.
You have to get a level. What do you think?
I think that people who don't have a BMP, which includes a calcium, are missing out because hypercalcemia occurs from a lot of things. The two most common are hyperparathyroidism and malignancies, but there are some granulomatous diseases that do it. There's some GI syndromes that do it. There's milk alkali. There's other things. And so I really think calcium ought to be part of your BMP, especially in older people, because you really don't want to miss this. Weakness, calcium.
It's so easy to miss. The symptoms are so vague. It can be just fatigue. They just don't feel well, or they're just a little confused. Yeah.
I mean, stuff that we deal with every day. The next article is from Koch et al., Duration of Red Cell Storage and Complications After Cardiac Surgery in New England Journal of Medicine in this year. Historical backdrop, it's been known that transfusion of red cells increases the risk of serious complications and death in critically ill patients, especially cardiac surgery patients. There have been several studies about transfusing older cells with variable results in small heterogeneous populations, some showing that it caused problems, others showing that it didn't. Board relevance, a little bit about this study. This is a very large study of adult patients undergoing either coronary artery bypass grafting and or valve surgery. Data was collected prospectively in a registry, which sounds a little bit like it was somewhat retrospectively looked at, but they've officially said it was prospective. Older cells were defined as those stored for greater than 14 days. And we're talking about red cells here, obviously. Newer red cells were stored for less than 14 days. Only patients who had received exclusively units with newer cells or older cells were included. So anybody that got both newer and older cells were taken out, which is a good thing. The primary endpoint was a composite of in-hospital death and a host of other bad things that they define in the article. Secondary endpoint was long-term survival. I think the most important thing from a board relevance standpoint is to understand what storage lesion is. There are 5 things associated with this, interestingly enough. Do I get points for 5?
Only with the boss.
Decreased deformability of red cells, which may lead to impedance to microvascular flow. Depletion of 2,3-DPG, which shifts oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve to the left and reduces oxygen delivery. Increased adhesiveness and aggregability, again, maybe contributing to clotting. Reduction in concentrations of nitric oxide and ATP, and then accumulation of pro-inflammatory bioactive substances, all of which sound bad and probably are bad.
Yeah.
It turns out that the only one you can actually make an impact on is 2,3-DPG, and when you do, it's difficult to reverse it, and it's slow to reverse, and it's never completely reversed. So the results. Basically, older blood was associated with, number one, higher in-hospital mortality, 2.8% versus 1.7%. And we ought to talk about these differences afterwards. Okay. Endotracheal tube beyond 72 hours, 9.7% versus 5.6%. Renal failure, 2.7% versus 1.6%. Sepsis or septicemia, 4% versus 2.8%. Lower one-year survival, 89% versus 92.6%. And then increase in composite of all the multitude of complications, right around 26% versus 22.4%. If you look at this article, there were differences in the significant comorbidities at baseline between the two groups, which may have affected the study, but it's a large enough study that those probably didn't matter, I would suspect. One of the major points I would take away is the differences between these outcomes, if you look at them, while statistically significant, are relatively small. Application to practice. Personally, if I need a blood transfusion, I'm going to ask for the newest blood they have down there in the blood bank.
This old blood is bad stuff.
However, if they don't have any new blood, based on the fact that it's not a big difference, I'll take the old blood, but I'd rather do the new blood. There may be a move to refine the way we save blood to retard development of the storage lesion, and they mention a number of things, but they don't go into them in detail. It's going to be impractical to decrease acceptable storage times to less than 42 days, which is the current standard at which we store blood. This study may not apply to other scenarios than cardiac surgery. I just don't know about your routine GI bleed and that kind of thing. And then I think the most important thing I would do is I would think very hard about pulling the transfusion trigger, not for just preserving blood for sicker people, but because there are bad potential side effects to transfusion. So I think we need to be a little more careful about blood than we've been in the past.
You know, the author said that if you used only blood that was less than 2 weeks old, the number needed to treat with fresh blood in order to prevent one death would be 28, which is it's pretty striking. I mean, this is a, I think it's a real phenomenon. But the problem is, if you only use fresh blood less than 2 weeks of age and you throw it out after that, we'd have no blood. I mean, it would completely deplete the blood supplies. So we find ourselves in a catch-22 of sorts. I mean, I think this has particular relevance for us as a trauma center and for other places with trauma centers because they take the old blood and they send it here because we're going to use it up faster. So in a sense, a lot of these trauma patients are getting old blood.
Yeah, I think the problem is going to be solved by the blood bank doing different things than they're doing now, maybe supplementing 2-3 DPG while they're storing it, and there's a bunch of other things they can do, it appears. I'm not sure. They don't go into detail, but there are things on the horizon that they're going to do which will allow them to store it longer with less storage lesion. So.
And that storage lesion, which is the decreased ATP, decreased permeability of the membrane and all, that really, they say it only occurs once the blood's been stored over 2 weeks.
That's correct.
Okay. Well,
it is a continuous phenomenon, but it accelerates after 2 weeks. So you got, you know, a 14-day versus a 16-day, I don't know, you know, that's sort of like any cutoffs. Yeah.
Ask for new blood. All right, the next article is by Peterson et al. Protective effect of antibiotics against serious complications of common respiratory tract infections. Retrospective cohort study with the UK General Practice Research Database. This is in the British Medical Journal, November of 2008. Historical backdrop, you know, we all wish we were antibiotic purists and we never prescribed an antibiotic, even when deep down in the core of our being we knew that the patient didn't need one. But we're not. At times we cave to the pressure of patient expectations or family expectations when they really just have a cold. And what these authors wanted to know is, are we harming patients if we withhold antibiotics? How often, for example, does pneumonia occur after an upper respiratory infection or chest infection, which in the U.S. we would call bronchitis? Or how often does mastoiditis happen after otitis media? Or how often does a patient get some sort of a pharyngeal abscess after a sore throat? The British call that a quinsy. As a matter of fact, that's...
I love that term.
Quinsy.
We should use it more.
Here's a little trivia for you. What did George Washington die of?
Quinsy.
How did you know that?
I don't know.
'Tis true, he did. In the UK, there's been a strong push to decrease antibiotic use for these types of infections. and this study sought to define the number needed to treat to prevent one of these complications. So for your boards, antibiotic overuse is probably the most important thing to blame for the rise in antibiotic resistance. I mean, obviously, the most prominent example would be MRSA, or methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. It's resistant to most beta-lactam antibiotics these days. Results. This was a retrospective study utilizing a huge primary care database in the United Kingdom. It included 3.36 million patients with upper respiratory infection, chest infection, aka bronchitis, sore throat, and otitis media. Some of these were treated with antibiotics, and some were not. And what they did is they compared the outcomes of each group, looking specifically for the complications of pneumonia as a complication of upper respiratory infection or chest infection, quinsy, or that's a pharyngeal abscess, as a complication of sore throat, and mastoiditis as a complication of otitis media. The number of serious complications was low at baseline, as you can imagine, and it was made lower by antibiotic use in patients that had a URI, sore throat, and otitis media. But the number needed to treat to prevent one of these complications in URI, sore throat, and otitis media was 4,000. That means you would have to see patients for several years with colds, otitis, and sore throat to prevent one case of these bad complications. However, in patients that were over 65 years of age that had chest infection, now this is not URI, this is chest infection or bronchitis, the number needed to treat to prevent one case of pneumonia was 39, so much more moderate number than 4,000. The number needed to treat was about 100 in patients that were younger than 65 years of age that had chest infection. And interestingly, the number needed to treat didn't change significantly in patients that had chronic lung disease, heart disease, or in smokers. I was kind of surprised about that. How does this apply to your practice? Well, to put this in perspective, it is true that antibiotics decrease the incidence of complications in patients that have cold, sore throat, and otitis media. But you're going to have to treat 4,000 patients before you're going to prevent one bad complication. And knowing that antibiotic resistance is on the rise, this doesn't seem like the smartest idea to me. However, if you have an elderly patient with any chest infection beyond a cold, course of antibiotics may prevent pneumonia after treating just 39 patients with antibiotics. That's a couple of shifts. The bottom line, I think we should still be pretty stingy with our antibiotics, but we might want to consider relaxing a bit in elderly patients with bronchitis. What do you think?
I think that's right. I think if you look at the data on bronchitis, acute bronchitis in particular, there really is almost no reason to treat it from a bacterial standpoint because the organisms that cause it are not really symptomatically relieved by antibiotics. They're more an issue of preventing transmission. We're talking about mycoplasma and pertussis. So I think bronchitis we should probably only treat in elderly people. I agree with that. Sore throats are interesting because I think personally that I'm a Centaur criteria guy, and we have those criteria, and they do sort of predict who might have a throat that's worth treating. And you can do that without waiting on a rapid strep test. So in my practice, I would probably use the Centaur criteria, reserving antibiotics for people who have three or four out of the Centaur criteria.
Yeah, because unfortunately at our shop, the rapid strep is a terrible misnomer because it's not so rapid.
It's about a 30 to 45 minute test. The Centaur criteria, just for those of you who don't remember, are fever, and I think it implies just subjective fever from the patient, exudate on the tonsil, anterior cervical adenopathy, and the absence of cough or rhinitis. So if you have three or four of those, I usually treat. When I treat with the bullets, I like penicillin.
Yeah, because we don't want to end up like George Washington, dead of quinsy.
Right. Having been bled with leeches.
I'm sure that didn't help.
Which contributed to his death, I suspect.
It hastened his demise. I mean, you think about this. He died of quinsy. I mean, we would just tube him and get him better.
Most of the people I see with quinsy actually are on antibiotics by the time I see them. It's very interesting. I know they showed that it does decrease it, but I don't know that it decreases it much. I think you're almost going to get quinsy regardless.
It seems like every Vanderbilt freshman gets quinsy.
That's correct.
I don't know what it is.
The thing to remember about quinsy is once you've had it, you're likely to get it again. So a history of Quincy would make me put somebody on antibiotics, I think, earlier than some other people.
You sound so British, saying Quincy a lot.
I like Quincy.
It makes it sound smart.
Do you have any tea?
Oh, very nice.
The next article is Williamson et al., Antibiotics and Topical Nasal Steroids for Treatment of Acute Maxillary Sinusitis from JAMA 2007. Historical backdrop, symptoms consistent with acute bacterial sinusitis are very common. Diagnostic confirmation of acute bacterial sinusitis is difficult. And one thing to remember is when you look at studies, there are studies that look at clinical cures versus bacteriologic cures. And I think studies that look at clinical cures are probably more relevant to our setting.
Mm-hmm. We don't do a lot of sinus punctures.
No, but that is the gold standard. There is widespread over-prescribing of antibiotics. The problems with this are economic costs and antibiotic resistance, as you mentioned before. The Cochrane database has looked at this and has shown moderate effect for penicillins in the treatment of people with sinusitis. Number needed to treat was 8, which is a pretty low number when you think about it. And intranasal steroids, they didn't say what the number needed to treat was. They said for every 100 patients, 7 would benefit. Board relevance, I would know that clinical criteria for sinusitis are as good or better, probably better than x-ray criteria. There are a bunch of different criteria. The ones used in this particular study were called the Berg-Karenfeld criteria, and they included, number one, purulent nasal discharge with unilateral predominance, local pain with unilateral predominance, number three, purulent nasal discharge bilaterally, and number four, pus on inspection inside the nose. You needed at least 2 out of 4 to be entered into the study and get antibiotics. There are some additional criteria that the ACP uses. They include symptoms greater than 10 days, unilateral maxillary molar pain, unilateral sinus tenderness, and then very importantly, if you had some sinus symptoms and were getting better and then you get worse suddenly, they thought that was very strong evidence. Of bacterial sinusitis. No single antibiotic class seems to work better than any other, and that means older and cheap is as good as newer and expensive. And in every study, about 70% of people get better without treatment. So, you know, it raises, who knows?
Yeah.
I don't know who to treat with sinusitis. This is a well-designed trial of adults that barely met its prescribed numbers by power calculation. There were 4 groups studied. Some people got antibiotics plus intranasal steroids, some got antibiotics plus placebo, some got intranasal steroids plus placebo, and some people got 2 placebos. The number in each group was relatively small, about 50, and I worry about the power calculation here for this kind of study, to be honest. They paid doctors to enroll, and a lot of people refused. Enrollment was physician instituted, which is also something of a problem because it raises the question of selection or spectrum bias. In other words, were there sicker patients that were just treated with antibiotics and not enrolled because they weren't willing to enroll them in a study with placebo? They just didn't feel good about it.
Yeah.
The use of either or both antibiotics and intrastate nasal steroids did not affect clinical cure as defined by a prescribed post-treatment questionnaire. Intranasal steroids did better in patients with less severe symptoms, but the more severe the symptoms, the worse patients did with the intranasal steroids. So I would remember this is not an ED population, which may select out somewhat sicker people, and it is from office practice. Applications to practice. How you use this article depends on whether you're more of a treater or a therapeutic nihilist. I think that we have overprescribed, and I think that if you're going to use antibiotics, you should have prescribed criteria you use. I personally like the ACP criteria better than the criteria used in this study. And I think if you're treating 10 to 20% of your sinusitis, you're doing pretty well at being a purist. That's not from a study, by the way. if there's no penicillin allergy, I would use amoxicillin in fairly high doses, like 500 TID. Otherwise, use the cheapest agent available. Intranasal steroids don't have very many downsides, like resistance, maybe economic things, but even those are pretty cheap right now. I think they should probably be used in patients with milder symptoms, obviously, and maybe in people who you really strongly suspect that they have an allergic component. From my personal experience, having been in a study where they were trying to do a viral infection study, I thought I had a bad viral infection one time, and I got studied with swabs and everything you can imagine, blood gases, you name it. It was a terrible study, squirting stuff up my nose and collecting it. And what it turned out is I was having allergies. It was in the fall, and I was having fall allergies. I had so many basophils, you wouldn't have believed it. So I don't think you can tell the difference between the two. But sometimes people have other, you know, it recurs twice a year kind of thing, you know.
And,
you know, you can kind of get an idea. This study is not going to change my practice. I'm going to continue to use antibiotics in some people. And I guess it's sick versus non-sick to some extent. But I'm going to use very specific criteria, as we mentioned.
You know, really, neither antibiotics or nasal steroids did any good. So, I don't know. I'm thinking if you can talk your patient out of antibiotics, do it. They're not going to be harmed by no antibiotics, and you're going to feel so good about yourself as you lower healthcare costs and decrease antibiotic resistance. Hardy har. If you can't talk them out of treatment with anything, maybe you can try a nasal steroid. It's not going to do them any good, but you may save them a case of C. difficile colitis. And if all else fails, just give them the darn antibiotics.
Yeah, I think there are people who for whom antibiotics are indicated, though. I do think there are some people with true bacterial sinusitis who are sick. And those people, I would have a hard time withholding antibiotics.
Especially, I know the ACP, the maxillary toothache, is probably one of the more specific.
So, that one and the getting worse after you initially got better.
Yeah, and the 10 days duration, I mean, they come in the first day of the illness and it's probably not sinusitis.
One thing we ought to mention is please do not get x-rays or CTs of the sinus on your standard person. It would be different with an HIV-positive person. That might be make a difference. But for standard run-of-the-mill sinusitis patients, that's a waste of money, a waste of radiation, and please don't get those because if you look at everyone who has influenza, they have air fluid levels in their sinuses, and they clearly don't have bacterial sinusitis in the early stages. So please don't get x-rays.
Yeah, save your millisieverts for later when the patient has trauma, and then we'll expose them to radiation.
Yes, a lot.
The next article, Sullivan et al., early treatment with prednisolone or acyclovir in Bell's palsy. This was in the New England Journal of Medicine in October of 2007. Historical backdrop. We often treat Bell's palsy with acyclovir and prednisone, but there's really not a whole lot of evidence for this practice. The idea behind acyclovir treatment is that some cases of, quote, Bell's palsy might be due to reactivated varicella. The editorial notes that one-third of cases of acute peripheral seventh nerve palsy are due to trauma, diabetes, hypertension, eclampsia, Ramsay-Hunt syndrome, which is zoster odicus, which would be the thing that would respond to acyclovir, Lyme disease, sarcoidosis, Sjogren's, amyloidosis, and even intranasal influenza vaccination. Bell's palsy includes the other two-thirds that are idiopathic. So technically a Bell's palsy doesn't have a defined etiology. If it has a defined etiology, it's just an acute peripheral seventh nerve palsy. So
there are studies that have looked at people who otherwise were thought to have Bell's palsy, ruling out most of those things, and they did herpes serology on them, and there was a fairly high incidence of herpes serology being positive. That's why the acyclovir was recommended.
The board relevance. Bell's palsy is a peripheral seventh cranial nerve palsy, and it affects both upper and lower parts of the face. A central seventh nerve palsy is going to have some degree of upper facial sparing. Whatever you treat with, whether acyclovir, prednisone, or both, don't forget to treat the patient's eye on the affected side with an ocular lubricant, especially at night, because if they have a true peripheral seventh nerve palsy or Bell's palsy, they can't fully close their eye if it's moderate to severe on that affected side, and they can get corneal desiccation and injury from that. That's an important board question. The results. This was a double-blind randomized placebo-controlled trial comparing four groups: acyclovir alone, prednisolone alone, acyclovir plus prednisolone, and placebo. The primary outcome was recovery of facial function using a standard score at 3 and 9 months, and symptoms had to be present 72 hours or less for them to be included in the study. 496 of the 551 patients were available for full follow-up. At 3 months, 83% of the patients that got prednisolone had recovered facial function versus only 63.6% of patients that did not receive prednisolone. This was highly statistically significant. Of those who received acyclovir, 71.2 versus 75.7 of those who did not receive acyclovir had recovered facial function. In other words, they did a little worse, but the difference was not statistically significant. So it actually looked like they did worse if they got acyclovir. At 9 months follow-up, 94.4% who received prednisolone and only 81.6% who did not receive prednisolone were completely recovered. The p-value for that was 0.001, highly significant. Of those who received acyclovir and those who did not, 85.4 versus 90.8 had complete recovery. Again, acyclovir recipients had a trend toward doing worse, but it wasn't statistically significant. P was 0.1. Now, of patients that got both prednisolone plus acyclovir versus the other groups, 79.7 had recovery at 3 months, and 92.7 had recovery at 9 months. This is very similar to the ones that got prednisolone alone. The number needed to treat with prednisolone to result in one patient having complete recovery of facial function at 3 months was only 6, and the number needed to treat to have complete recovery at 9 months was 8. So how does this apply to your practice? Well, it does change things for me. I've always used acyclovir for Bell's palsy. You know, there's no doubt, I think, from this study that glucocorticoid use is mandatory unless it's absolutely contraindicated. But I would say, before you throw out acyclovir altogether, there's one caveat mentioned by the editorialist that I think is worthy of consideration. There's another study, a Japanese study by Hato et al., of valacyclovir, or Valtrex, that included patients that had more severe Bell's palsy symptoms. And the number needed to treat with valacyclovir plus prednisone in patients that had complete or severe facial nerve palsy was only 7, so it actually seemed to help them. In the current study, the patients enrolled had a more moderate palsy than the ones in the Hato study. Similarly, in the Hato study, patients in the subgroup with moderate palsy had no improvement with valacyclovir. So if you have a moderate palsy, valacyclovir or acyclovir is probably not going to help you. Bottom line, prednisone for everybody, and add acyclovir or valacyclovir for those with a severe or complete facial nerve palsy. That's what I would say.
And I don't terribly disagree with that, except the one mistake I see in this article is that they used a lower dose of acyclovir than I would have used. They used the 400 rather than the 800.
Yeah, and I always treat with 800 five times a day.
Yeah, 800 for these non-vaginal, genital herpes is what you're supposed to use. And so I think they used the wrong dose, and it wouldn't have been any more expensive to use the big dose. And that may be the difference between the valacyclovir, which we know is actually a better drug than acyclovir, and its bioavailability. You only have to give it once a day, et cetera, or
twice a day.
And so I worry about the dosing here. However, having said that, I think the thing I would remember is you're going to be writing a lot of prescriptions and having to do some teaching to these people before they go home. You have to teach them to double patch at night, which is a very important skill, and not everyone knows how to do that. So you have to write for those little patches. You have to write for the prednisone. You have to write for Lacrolube ointment to put in at night before you double patch them. And then you have to give natural tears to use every hour or two during the day. And then you may or may not want to give them acyclovir or valacyclovir. But if you're going to use acyclovir, I would bump it up to 800 rather than 400.
And I would certainly use it in patients that had a more severe or a complete facial nerve palsy, because that's the segment of the population with Bell's that probably gets improvement. And you only have to treat 7 patients to get a complete recovery. That's huge if your face is drooping.
Yeah. And it turns out more people than I thought actually have incomplete recovery. It used to be thought it was only 15%, but in some of these studies it's higher than that. So, which is cosmetically not so good. Wouldn't matter in me, but it might matter in you as a younger man. Although you got 6 kids, yeah, who cares?
Who cares?
So the one thing I would say is if you're going to use acyclovir, I'd use a bigger dose. If the person has insurance, I'd use valacyclovir. I really think it's a better drug.
I'm just saying, I would never take a drug 5 times a day.
This is a very elegantly done study. If you're going to read a well-done study, this is almost perfect, with the exception of the wrong dose. But the methodology was superb.
They did digital photos and had plastic surgeon and EMT.
Everything right.
Nice job.
Next article is sensitivity and specificity of a single ED measurement of urinary neutrophil gelatinase-associated lipokalin, known as NGAL, for diagnosing acute kidney injury. It's from Annals of Internal Medicine in 2008. Historical backdrop, acute kidney injury is common. Now, I think we ought to step aside a little bit later and talk about the terminology here, but acute kidney injury means there's actually some injury to cells in the kidney. The incidence is increasing, and 20 to 60% of patients with acute kidney injury go on to dialysis. Associated mortality ranges all the way from 15 to 80%, depending on comorbidities. Acute kidney injury is separate from pre-renal azotemia, where various factors such as volume depletion, drugs such as ACE inhibitors or diuretics are a problem. And it reverses quickly with volume repletion and stopping the offending agents. It's also distinct from chronic stable or chronic progressive kidney failure. And then lastly, the serum creatinine, and this is really important, does not distinguish well acute kidney injury from the other two types of renal failure. Creatinine rises lag behind acute kidney injury by hours to a couple of days. And so can't depend on a single serum creatinine for this. And that's why they studied the NGAL. Board relevance. Acute kidney injury requires early diagnosis to maximize prevention of further injury and get them treated with dialysis as quick as possible, if needed. The NGAL is secreted by the thick ascending limb of Henle and collecting ducts of the kidney. It's expressed in proportion to the degree of acute injury. In animal studies, NGAL is not expressed in either pre-renal azotemia or progressive chronic kidney disease. So that's why they studied it in humans. You measure it from the urine, which is non-invasive, unless you need a Foley. And the causes of acute kidney injury in this study, in order of most to least common, were cardiogenic shock, urinary obstruction, multiple myeloma, sepsis, hypertensive emergency, non-steroidal nephrotoxicity, lupus nephritis, acute interstitial nephritis, glomerular nephritis, and rhabdomyolysis, all of which we see pretty commonly here. At a community hospital, it would probably might be a little different. Results. In adults, increases in urinary NGAL were associated with the following. In acute kidney injury defined by a rise in creatinine that was new and didn't get better with volume repletion, NGAL was markedly elevated and statistically different from normals, pre-renal azotemia, and chronic progressive kidney disease. Using ROC curves, urine NGAL was better than any other marker, and they studied several others for predicting as a single initial measurement. The sensitivity for predicting acute kidney injury was in the range of 90 to 93%, depending on which cutoff value you use. They used both 85 micrograms per gram or 130 micrograms per gram. The specificity was in the range of 98 to 100%. A urine NGAL greater than 130 was predictive of getting a nephrology consultation, initiation of dialysis, and ICU admission more so than any other biomarkers. If you looked at all the things, urine NGAL was the best, but also serum creatinine, BUN, and serum leukocyte count were all predictive of poor outcome in multiple logistic regression analysis. Age, sex, race, and comorbidities were not, interestingly enough. So application to practice. Here's where I need to discuss terminology. There are two main kinds of kidney failure. There's acute and chronic. And you can subdivide acute into pre-renal azotemia and acute kidney injury, I think. And I think that's what we formerly called ATN. And it's changed now to acute kidney injury, meaning there's cell death. And then we're going to talk about why that's important. There is, of course, acute on chronic kidney failure of both types. And certainly pre-renal azotemia, if it goes on long enough, will start to cause acute kidney injury. So there's no absolute differences, but I think this may be a pretty good test for predicting who has reversible, not so bad pre-renal azotemia from people who are having acute kidney injury with a poor prognosis. And the reason this is important, I think, is to think of this like a cardiac biomarker. Yeah. This is a kidney biomarker of cell injury.
It's like a kidney troponin.
That's correct. It's a kidney troponin. And so in situations like someone who comes in who looks dry and their BUN's high, you might get a urinary NGAL, and if they have greater than 85 or 130, whichever cutoff we decide is the right cutoff eventually, that person might need to be admitted.
Yeah.
As opposed to someone, their urinary ingal is not, you may hydrate them a while, and if they get better, they might, and they can eat and drink, et cetera, they might go home. They might. Yeah. It might help you with that, sort of like we're doing with cardiac observation now on cereal. And on a single ingal seemed to work. Now, we may do cereal ingals and see if they rise. I don't know, that'll be interesting. The other situation which comes up a lot is in hypertensive patients who have borderline creatinines anyway a lot of times, who come in with pressure out of control.
Yeah.
And their creatinine is 1.5 or 1.6, and it's 1.4 to before, and you're going, is this an emergency? Is it not?
Is this end organ damage?
Yeah. So you get a urinary ingal and it's elevated, there's acute end organ damage. They need to be admitted and they need to be on a drip.
Absolutely.
As far as I'm concerned. So I see this like cardiac biomarkers in a lot of situations helping us. I don't think it's here yet, and I mean literally and figuratively. I think we got a little more time to decide about it, but I've asked the lab if they would look into getting it for us. I would like to see studies in the hypertensive patients, in the people with really high pressures, to see if it would make a difference in how we evaluated people and some of the pre-renals. And I think we could do it here. We have enough patients. It's very interesting.
You know, I could see a use too. Sometimes children come in and, you know, they can get really dry and their creatinine can go up. And you might say, well, you know, is this acute renal injury? Do they have some sort of HUS? I mean, obviously there are other lab abnormalities that go with that, but can I feel comfortable giving this kid some volume? Or elderly patients that come in from the nursing home, is this acute renal failure from some drug that they've been taking? Or can I go ahead and give them some volume? And it could really help you feel more comfortable with your management. If they had a normal urinary ingal, you could pound them with some fluids and know that you're not going to overload them from a renal standpoint.
Yeah, from a renal standpoint.
Maybe not from a cardiac standpoint, but you could feel more comfortable giving them some volume. You know, the positive likelihood ratio of this test was 181, and the negative likelihood ratio was 0.1. This is a very powerful discriminator as far as a diagnostic test, and I really think soon to be gone are the days when we have to calculate a FINA.
Or looking at BUN creatinine ratios and that kind of thing. I don't know how many people I've seen with totally normal BUN creatinine ratios who are dry as a bone.
Pre-renal, yeah. It's like urine spec graph. It just stinks.
Yes, none of those things help. And who wants to do a FINA? I don't remember the last time I've done it, and I don't want to do anymore. So I like this test. I suspect it'll be expensive to start with. We'll see. So the next article is Scarborough et al. It's corticosteroids for bacterial meningitis in adults in sub-Saharan Africa, New England Journal of Medicine, 2007. Historical backdrop, studies have shown that corticosteroids appear to alter the mortality in adult patients with bacterial meningitis in the developed world. The study was done in one of those northern
Europe.
Denmark, Sweden, Finland, something, particularly with pneumococcal meningitis. In children, steroids were shown to alter hearing loss after H influenza B meningitis. However, with the HIV vaccine, steroids in children has fallen out of favor. So currently, we're in a situation where steroids are indicated in adults and not indicated in children, if I'm not mistaken, even here. Board relevance. I think it's currently standard of care to give steroids in adults before the time of antibiotic administration. The dexamethasone dose is 10 milligrams every 6 hours for 48 hours or so. Studies in different populations, in other words, less developed countries with much higher rates of HIV, advanced HIV, TB, have not been yet done. There was a study from Malawi where this study was done that we're discussing now in children that showed no benefit from steroids. And that's not a place where they do HIV vaccines very much, I think. Results. This is a fairly well-designed trial given that where it's at and with the major hurdles they have to jump through to actually do a study. It's got really excellent follow-up. Mm-hmm. I mean, better than we could get here.
Yeah, it is.
Considering their lack of resources, it's amazing they could do this study at all. The clinical criteria for the diagnosis of bacterial meningitis are not as rigorous as they would be here in the United States or in Europe. And there were people with lots of other problems in this study. Huge percentage of patients were HIV positive, and many had advanced disease, much more than we see here. Mortality rate was greater than 50%, which is also much higher than in the U.S. And the people here presented an average of about 72 hours, which would be very late.
Yeah.
We usually get them within 24. In this environment, steroids made no difference, even in patients with pneumococcal disease. As a sidelight, they also studied IM versus IV ceftriaxone because IM is much cheaper in that setting, and people did just as about as well with either IM or IV ceftriaxone. So I think it's important to mention another article in the same volume of the New England Journal out of Vietnam. It's Mai et al., MAI, Dexamethasone in Vietnamese Adolescents and Adults with Bacterial Meningitis, New England Journal of Medicine, 2007 again. And they found dexamethasone didn't make any difference in all people with, quote, suspected meningitis, unquote. However, they subdivided people into those with confirmed and probable and then maybe less probable. When they looked at confirmed meningitis cases, there was a definite reduction, which was significant, in risk of death at 1 month and risk of death or disability at 6 months. However, in the subset of patients with probable meningitis, steroids conferred an increased risk of death at 1 month, thought to be explained by cases of tuberculous meningitis, which is fairly common there. Application to practice. If you're practicing in an underdeveloped country where resources are scarce and the HIV-TB prevalence is high, be careful with steroids and meningitis. I would only use it if you were pretty damn sure you had bacterial meningitis. In the U.S., I think steroids are still indicated in adults thought to have bacterial meningitis. I think it would be nice to have another confirmatory study done in the U.S. I don't think we have that yet. In children, steroids are not currently indicated for the treatment of bacterial meningitis, I think. There are people who look like they have definite bacterial meningitis who are sick, and there are people in whom bacterial meningitis is kind of a rule-out. They've got fever and a headache, but they're less sick. Steroids and antibiotics within 30 minutes... should be the rule of thumb for people with sick, definite bacterial meningitis. Compared to the people who are just the rule-outs, I think you can wait for LP results, even if you have to do a CT first before you make the jump to doing steroids and antibiotics. And I think that's really important. One critical thing is to get blood cultures before antibiotics. Of all the infections we talk about, this is the one which has pretty much the highest rate of return. And even in this study from Malawi, it was in the 40% range. So this is a disease of sepsis.
It's a lot of bacteremia. Well, looks like steroids were a bust in this population, in this African study that had a high HIV prevalence. However, it looks like in developed countries, it's probably still the way to go to give dexamethasone with or just prior to getting your antibiotics.
I think that's right. I'm not going to change my practice based on this study because our population is so different than
it's
the ones they've studied.
Totally different demographics, far, far delayed in Africa, and also the patients who had more significant comorbidity and high HIV prevalence. What was it, 70, 80?
Well, I think
90%.
90%.
There's a lot of patients.
Yeah,
there's
a lot. And in the Vietnamese study, there was a lot of TB. I mean, they were really heavy with TB meningitis, which we... I don't know the last time you saw TB meningitis, but it's been probably since I was at Grady Hospital, so that's a long time.
And finally, we're going to do an ID update. There's so much going on in the field of infectious disease. It's considered, as far as keeping up goes, as a part of general medicine, and we thought the best way to give you the latest ID information was to do it similar to a keeping update, that is, by using somewhat of a headline news approach. There were numerous articles worthy of mentioning, and all of them are important for you as ED docs to know about, but most of the articles have only a couple of key points. There are 9 of them, and I'm going to just bust through them really fast. As far as board relevance, mumps causes fever and inflammation of the salivary glands, most notably the parotid glands, 90% of the time. It's actually fairly rare in the other salivary glands. Next, as far as what you need to know for your boards, West Nile virus is an arbovirus transmitted by mosquitoes. It can cause meningitis, encephalitis, and acute flaccid paralysis. Next, MRSA is an ever-increasing problem in the ED. Think MRSA, or MRSA, methicillin-resistant staph aureus, when you've got a patient with a furuncle, and just assume that it's methicillin-resistant and treat accordingly. Know your local resistance patterns and use trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole or clindamycin versus vancomycin if they're sick as needed. Next, Neisseria meningitidis can cause severe sepsis and meningitis, and close contacts with a source patient need chemoprophylaxis. That is, they need something to eliminate nasal carriage of N meningitidis. That has been, historically in adults, ciprofloxacin or fluoroquinolone, one dose and you're good to go. However, know your local fluoroquinolone resistance patterns because we're going to talk about an MMWR report that is pretty concerning. Next, measles classically causes the three C's, cough, coryza, and conjunctivitis. And lest we forget, the morbilliform rash. Take a look at the CDC definition below. Finally, if you have a febrile patient that's returning from travel abroad, think about malaria. You can check the CDC.gov website to learn if your patients recently traveled to a malaria endemic part of the world. The results, the first article was by Dayan et al., a recent resurgence of mumps in the United States, New England Journal of Medicine, April of 2008. There was an epidemic of mumps in 2006 across the U.S., but it was concentrated in the Midwest. Mumps causes unilateral or bilateral parotitis in over 90% of cases, as well as fever and other constitutional symptoms. It may manifest with other salivary gland inflammation or the following complications: orchitis, oophoritis, or inflammation of your ovaries, mastitis, meningitis, encephalitis, deafness, and pancreatitis. Most of these cases occurred in immunized individuals. That's people who got their vaccinations, and greater than 80% of those who were affected were college age. So the application, what do you need to know if you see a suspected case of mumps? The patient should be isolated for 5 days from school or work. In the past, the recommendation was 9 days of isolation, but this was recently shortened after this epidemic to 5 days. And you also need to inform the patient about those complications that may arise so they can seek care if it happens to them. And be aware, mumps is still around. I have seen 2 cases of bilateral parotitis in the past couple of months. The patients look like chipmunks. I don't know if they had mumps or not.
Did you do serology?
Yeah, I did on one, and she didn't have it.
There are a lot of things that cause parotitis, especially in adults. Alcoholics have bilateral parotitis, but it's worrisome that it's coming back. It's another situation where, you know, you begin to wonder if we're winning the war or just winning battles.
They were
orchitis thing,
yeah,
that's a big problem.
Ouch.
Yeah. I don't want that.
Don't get it.
I didn't have mumps as a child, and I didn't get the vaccine because it wasn't around when I was young. That was a newer vaccine. So when I was in medical school, I got exposed to mumps and had to get vaccinated. I remember, but my serologies were negative. So I've now been vaccinated.
I was going to say, you better.
Now, were these people these were college-age kids?
Most of them.
Is this thought to be waning immunity?
These were people that got 2 doses of MMR.
At what ages?
As kids.
So you wonder if there's waning immunity.
That's kind of what they suspected. They gave a lot of the patients boosters.
So maybe you need another booster.
Yeah, that was the thought. So I don't know why these people are getting it. The next article was written by Hall et al., Estimation of HIV Incidence in the United States, JAMA, June of 2008. How many new cases of HIV were diagnosed in 2006? That's what this study sought to answer, and the answer is 56,300 were diagnosed. Most were in black patients and in men who had sex with men. This was done in using a relatively new assay that can distinguish recent from a remote infection to truly calculate the incidence rather than relying on back calculation. Now remember the difference between incidence and prevalence. Incidence means the rapidity with which newly diagnosed patients develop in a given period of time. Prevalence means the number of existing cases in a population. The incidence or incidence rate of HIV is stable, but that's still a lot of new cases in 2006, over 56,000. That's 9 times the population of the town that I grew up in. The application to your clinical practice, we can have an impact on cases of acute HIV if we diagnose it. It's out there, guys. Have it on your radar screen when a patient presents with a mono-like illness and risk factors for HIV.
This also brings up the question about screening. Which we're doing some of. It's very difficult to establish screening programs, but the reason we do that is because new cases are felt to be a result of undiagnosed cohorts.
Yeah.
So if we can pick up people who don't know they have the disease and change their behaviors and maybe get them into early treatment, we may make a difference in the incidence and long-term in the prevalence. We'll see more about screening. The recent CDC thing was we're still not doing very well at screening. And I will tell you how difficult it is to do screening. It's very difficult. Looks like our rate here when we did screening is somewhere around 0.3%, which is very low.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in some upcoming months. There are some articles that have come out, so you'll have to stay tuned to Keeping Up if you want to learn about that, or you could just go read the articles. Next, West Nile virus by Gene et al. Risk factors for West Nile virus neuroinvasive disease, California 2005. This was in Emerging Infectious Diseases in December of 2007. 880 cases of West Nile virus occurred in California in 2005. 305 of these had neuroinvasive disease, which includes meningitis, encephalitis, or acute flaccid paralysis. What they wanted to find out is what puts people at risk for neuroinvasive diseases as opposed to just West Nile fever, which consists of fever, headache, and nonspecific muscle weakness. The authors found that the following factors independently correlated with developing neuroinvasive disease. If you were older age, that is greater than 64 years, male gender, hypertensive, and diabetic. So the people that get heart attacks are the same people that get serious West Nile virus. Dang! Why diabetes and hypertension? Well, he said possibly it's an impaired immune response in patients that are diabetic, an increased viremia, possibly a more leaky blood-brain barrier in those that had hypertension. That was what they hypothesized. But the application of practice is this. In mosquito weather, fever, headache, meningitis, encephalitis, or acute flaccid paralysis may be a manifestation of West Nile virus infection. Elderly, diabetic, hypertensive patients are at higher risk for serious illness. And there was also a little West Nile virus update that was done in July of 2008, and it's the number of cases from January to July of this year, and 43 cases of West Nile virus were reported to the CDC as of July 22nd, 2008. 16 of those had neuroinvasive disease. Next.
Can I just say
that
this is a bad disease, but fortunately it's like rabies. If I miss it, I couldn't have done anything about it anyway.
That's true. That's true. It's not like there's the West Nile antibiotic or something.
Yes, and so right now I feel a little, because this presents like other viruses. I mean, I would miss this. And you know what it really looks like is these tick-borne illnesses, which we have so much time. And I don't think doxycycline works on this.
No, not last check.
So fortunately for me, I take comfort in the fact that if I miss the West Nile virus, which I'm pretty sure it does not currently have a test we can get on a timely basis or treatment, then so be it.
Yeah. If you've got old people bitten by a skeeter, who cares?
Who's not in the South? So.
I don't know. Old people, skeeters. Next is MRSA, Klein et al., hospitalizations and deaths by methicillin-resistant Staph aureus in the United States, 2005, also in Emerging Infectious Diseases, printed in December of 2007. Staph aureus is nasty, and methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, MRSA, is nastier. Staph aureus is the leading cause of hospital-acquired lower respiratory infections and surgical site infections. It's the second leading cause of nosocomial bacteremia, pneumonia, and cardiovascular infections in hospitalized patients. MRSA is on the rise as well, and this study measured the incidence, or the increase in Staph aureus and MRSA-related hospitalizations and deaths from 1999 to 2005. Hospitalizations related to Staph aureus increased 62% from 1999 to the year 2005. Hospitalizations due to MRSA doubled from 1999 to 2005, going from 127,000 to over 278,000. The majority of this increase, however, was from cellulitis and abscess. There was no increase in death from Staph aureus or MRSA. It appears that MRSA-related hospitalizations are largely due to introduction of MRSA from the community into the hospital instead of vice versa. It's community acquired these days. So how does this apply to your practice? And what can you do to reverse this trend? Well, the authors suggest that hand washing is the key defense. Next, the use of contact precautions when you're dealing with potential MRSA skin infections and when you're performing wound care, because it's coming from the community into the hospital nowadays instead of from the hospital out into the community. Any thoughts?
We've certainly, since in the last 10 years, seen a huge increase in MRSA in the ED. We've got data to show a gigantic increase, and it went up very suddenly. So some switch flipped, and MRSA developed a problem. A board question that you may ought to think about is this PVL thing.
Pantone, Valentine, leucocidin,
yeah,
whatever.
That's a bad thing to have. Not all the MRSA has that, but when they have that, it chews things up.
It's a cool mechanism how that works, that Pantone, Valentine, it punches holes in your neutrophils.
Right, and it also punches holes in your lungs if you get it in your lungs.
I'm
not sure why we're seeing MRSA pneumonia. I don't really understand who gets it and what. I'd love to see a study showing who's at risk for that. But we've had a couple of cases in peds recently here, and those people end up on 5 antibiotics.
They are sick.
They're very sick and a high mortality rate. So keep that in the back of your mind for pneumonia stuff.
All right, next, meningococcal resistance to fluoroquinolones. This is in MMWR. There's emergence of fluoroquinolone-resistant Neisseria meningitidis in Minnesota, North Dakota, 2007-2008. This was published in February of 2008. Meningococcal disease has a 10% mortality rate. To catch it, patients have to first have nasopharyngeal carriage of Neisseria meningitidis. And this is a lot more likely to occur when you've been exposed or in close contact with an infected person. Invasive disease, if you're colonized, is usually going to occur, if it will occur, within 2 weeks. Sporadic fluoroquinolone resistance to Neisseria meningitidis had occurred in other countries, but it had never occurred in the U.S. until recently. There were 3 cases of fluoroquinolone-resistant meningococcus occurring along the North Dakota-Minnesota border from January of 2007 to January of 2008. Usually, a one-time dose of Cipro is adequate chemoprophylaxis if you're in close contact with an infected patient. Now the CDC recommends in these certain counties in North Dakota and Minnesota chemoprophylaxis with ceftriaxone, rifampin, or azithromycin as alternative agents. So the application is if you live in North Dakota or Minnesota, you need to check the CDC website to find out if you're in an affected county. And if you don't live there, the next case where you have to treat close contacts, you may want to double check with your health department to make sure that fluoroquinolone resistance hasn't emerged in your neck of the woods.
Do we know here?
We don't have it here, as far as I know. It's only North Dakota.
I'm taking the ceftriaxone.
Next, influenza activity in the United States and worldwide 2007 and 2008 season, also MMWR in June of 2008. The peak season of flu this year in 2008 was in early to mid-February. The H1N1 subtype was the most common and most prevalent strain. Less common was H3N2. 11% of the H1N1 isolates were resistant to the oseltamivir, Tamiflu, and none were resistant to zanamivir. All of the H3N2 isolates were sensitive to oseltamivir, and almost all the Flu A isolates were resistant to amantadine. So it just does not work in Flu A anymore. 30% of cases this past year were due to influenza B. And the peak of pneumonia and influenza deaths was in March. It peaked at 9.1% of cases. This is epidemic level. The application of your practice, the CDC still recommends oseltamivir this year because they expect that the H3N2 strain is going to be prevalent. So keep watch for further updates as far as the oseltamivir resistance patterns this flu season coming up.
You get the test?
Flu test?
The flu test.
Yeah, I kind of like to do it. It makes me feel better. I sleep better when they have fever, headache. I'm like, they have meningitis.
This is one of those tests when it's positive, it helps you.
Yeah.
As opposed to being negative, which is a lot of what we like to see is negative tests. So
yeah, I like when it's positive.
When it's positive, it helps you because you don't have to tap people and do chest x-rays.
Exactly. Like when it's negative, I'm hating my life because I'm in there.
Are you a Tamiflu guy? Do you treat?
Yeah, if they're within 48 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, it shortens the illness by a couple of days.
Yeah, some people say, why? What difference does it make?
I think it shortens the duration and gets people to work.
I think economically, if you think about it, 2 days of work is a lot of money, especially for someone like you. So if I had to come in and do Jeopardy for you for 2 days, that's a couple $1,000s.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money. And for people on the other end of the spectrum, you know, we're making a lot of money in these minimum wagers. You miss 2 days of work at Walmart, you may be fired.
You sure might. Or, if you don't work at all, it gets him back to the couch faster.
That's correct.
That's what I want. Next, a little bit about measles. An update on measles in the United States, January to July of 08, MMWR, July of 2008. Measles cases are still reported in the U.S. 131 cases were reported from January to July in 2008. Most of these occurred in unimmunized people. These were people that, by in large part, had philosophical or religious beliefs that said, don't get immunized for some reason. And guess what? The most common infection that you're going to get if you decide not to get immunizations, the first one that's going to make a comeback, measles. It's still out there because it gets imported into the United States. I think the most important thing is to consider measles and to recognize it. The standard CDC case definition is, quote, an illness characterized by a generalized maculopapular rash for greater than 3 days, a temperature greater than 101 degrees Fahrenheit, that's 38.3 Celsius, and the classic three C's, cough, coryza, conjunctivitis. The application, why should you care? Well, I think we should care because measles caused 450 deaths and 4,000 cases of encephalitis prior to availability of the measles vaccination. It's highly contagious, and affected individuals should be warned of the complications and kept isolated. And you should also be notifying your public health officials if you see a case that you're suspicious is measles.
I had measles as an 8-year-old, and I got it on an airplane in the United States. About 50% of the people on the plane got it from another little girl that was on the plane with us, and I wasn't even close to her, as I remember. So it's very, very contagious.
It's a very high attack rate. Next, and finally, malaria. Imported malaria in high-risk groups, an observational study using UK surveillance data, 1987 to 2006, British Medical Journal, July of 2008, written by Smith et al. This was a review of 39,300 cases of malaria in the United Kingdom between 1987 and 2006. The number of falciparum versus vivax cases increased dramatically. Also, in the UK, 64% of cases were in travelers who were returning from visiting family members in either Africa or Asia. People that visited family members were much less likely to use chemoprophylaxis, odds ratio 0.23. Application of practice, why should you care? Well, we should care because we actually see this, or you should be seeing it. I've seen 2 cases of malaria in Nashville, Tennessee. One patient was from Sierra Leone, I think, and they presented with epigastric abdominal pain, which is a really common presentation. The other was an immigrant who had just, or a refugee from Myanmar or Burma, and the child was febrile and pale. Really, if you don't think about malaria in these returning travelers or immigrants or refugees, especially from, you know, just check cdc.gov and find out if they're from a malaria endemic area. But if you don't think about it, you're going to miss it. And all you have to do is order a malaria smear and you might save a life.
Yeah, this is not like West Nile virus where there's nothing you can do. Yeah. This one you can treat. To give props to Seth Wright, who's been sending out these almost daily tropical medicine things. Here's my take on tropical medicine. Malaria.
TB.
TB, HIV, and leishmaniasis.
Leishmaniasis and leprosy.
Those 5 things. You just think about those 5 things. You'd be right about 97.6% of the time.
And most of the patients will have all of the above.
Yes, often
TB,
they do.
TB, HIV, yes. Got it all.
I had leishmaniasis as a child as well.
Good grief.
You're
so full of crap. Are you serious?
Yeah.
Did you catch it on a plane?
No, I caught it in Panama. I had a big sore on my leg. Just went away. We didn't treat it or anything.
Sheesh. Did you get antimony or whatever?
No, I just...
Pentastem?
I got to go to the beach and soak in the ocean for a week and out of school.
That's sweet.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I wish I could get leishmaniasis. You think Corey would let me off work?
No.
Okay. Well, you've done it again. You've just spent over an hour listening to another episode of Keeping Up. Oh my gosh, it was so much fun recording with Keith Wren this month. And I hope you get a lot of educational value out of it. And I certainly hope you get a lot of laughs. I sure did as I was editing this. It's just a lot of fun. Tune in next month. I will be recording with Dr. Jim Fichtel again. As you know, he recorded the 2007 LLSA articles with me and also did the trauma articles. We'll be talking next month about airway, ultrasound, and procedures. We have a bunch of articles that have been submitted by our Keeping Up faculty, and we're trying to whittle them down to the top 10 so that you get the very best of the best of what's happened in the past year in emergency medicine regarding airway procedures and ultrasound. So stay tuned next month, and we'll bring you more of the very best, bringing current literature to bear on your clinical practice. And now for a little legal and CME mumbo jumbo that we have to take care of. Keeping Up is copyright Vanderbilt University, 2008-2009, all rights reserved. Please don't make copies or change the content in any way, but please do tell your friends about this because that's the way we're going to spread the word. Don't forget to get your CME credit. You can get that by going to our website, www.keepingupinem.com, and follow the links. Vanderbilt University School of Medicine is accredited by the Accreditation Council for CME to provide continuing medical education for physicians. Vanderbilt University School of Medicine designates this educational activity for a maximum of 1.5 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. Physicians should only claim credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. Thanks so much for listening to Keeping Up. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we hope you'll listen again and tell your friends. Thanks. Bye.